ICQ Podcast episode 421, New Year Ham Radio Hints and Tricks. Well, hello fellow amateur ham radio enthusiasts, and welcome to this, the 421st episode of the ICQ Amateur Ham Radio Podcast, supported by our monthly and annual subscription donors. In this episode, we join Martin, M&RB, Chris, Mike Zero, Tango Charlie Hotel, Martin, Mike Zero, Sierra Golf Lima, Frank, K4, Foxtrot Mike Hotel, Bill, Whiskey Charlie 3 Bravo, Ed, DD5 Lima Papa, and Leslie, Golf Zero Charlie India Bravo, to discuss the latest amateur radio news. Myself, Colin, M6PRY, rounds up the news in brief, and this episode's feature are New Year ham radio hints and tips. Well, as mentioned, it's always our monthly and subscription donors that help us pay our way and keep us producing your show for you free of charge with our advertising every fortnight. And we would ask you to consider us here in 2024 to help us out and support us. It's a very thing to do. We ask you on to follow the value for value model. So think about the value you got from today's show and what you might have learned or picked up, or any hints and tricks you might find in the feature. And they say turn it into a monetary value. Go to icqpodcast.com/donate and send that monetary value to us to help us pay our way and keep your show produced for you advert free every fortnight. Right, we're going to join a bumper roundtable as we join the two Martins, Chris, Frank, Bill, Ed and Leslie, to discuss and generate thoughts about the latest amateur radio news, including assistance needed for CubeSat projects and base stations of frequencies expanded. As always, hope you enjoy.
Well, hi guys, and welcome to episode 421 of the ICQ podcast and tonight's roundtable for that episode. This is the first episode of the new year in 2024. Not a lot of new stories around, but we've done our best to find you some interesting ones. And we've got an enlarged full house tonight, which I'll take you through. I'm joined by Mr. Chris Howard, M0TCH. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Martin. Happy New Year. Happy 2024.
Yeah, happy New Year to you. And the same, we'll see more of you, I'm sure, as the year goes on. I'd like to welcome Mr. Martin Ruffell, M0SGL, who not got me into much trouble over Christmas, did you?
Well, you've been busy, mate. There's still plenty of time. Well, we're still in January, so I'll try and get you in as much trouble as possible throughout January. How's that work for you?
I thought you might. Now, we're going to switch the other side of the pond. Mr. Frank Howell, K4FMH, is with us. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Martin. Hey, everyone. Happy New Year. Great to be here. And guess what? The daily sunspot cycle as we record this is 175 with an SFI of 176.
Sounds good to me, Frank. Staying the other side of the pond, we have Mr. Bill Barnes, WC3B. Hi, Bill.
Well, good evening, everybody.
We also have, in the UK, Mr. Leslie Butterfield, G0CIB.
Good evening, Martin. Great to be back again.
Yeah, great to have you. And as an extra pleasure for us all, we've asked Mr. Ed Rant, DD5LP, to join us tonight, because you can't make the next episode, can you?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a pleasure for the listeners, but I'm here anyway. Happy New Year to all the listeners and to the team and the group here tonight.
Yeah, good to have you. Right, let's have a look at our first news story. Assistance requested with the CubeSat History Project. This is an AMSAT community thing, but there's information on some of these satellites that has gone a little bit awry. And AMSAT are trying to obviously find out more about them and make sure the history is right. Frank, do you want to go first on this one?
Sure. I enjoy social history, and I think documenting the history of some of our technological elements. Listeners may remember I did a feature a year or two ago about the history of amateur radio in the U.S. and who organized it first, not what you would hear in most of our magazines and books. So it's good to go back and do this, to document things that we've convinced ourselves it's thus and so, and it just may not be. So Professor Bob Twiggs, KE6QMD, and Dr. Aaron Zuckerman, KM6CHY, former student of his. They're leading an effort on gathering and publishing a series on the history and creation of the CubeSat. Now, I know the other commenters will have some thoughts about that, and particularly Bill. I think Bill keeps up with satellite stuff as much or more than any of us. So they're doing that, and how do we get these small satellites? And I think you're going to find when it comes out, and even what they already have, it may not be what you initially think, Martin.
Well, you know, looking back at history, sometimes it isn't what you necessarily think, but when you actually look at it for real, that's when you start to understand what really happened. You said Bill will be knowledgeable on this one. So, Bill, would you like to go next?
Yeah, this is actually a retired professor who's co-authoring a book about the history of CubeSats and pocket CubeSats. I can't imagine, you know, like our resident professor Frank, who retired, to have all this time to write a book. This is going to be a pretty interesting book, because it's not only just going to be about technical, it's going to be about all the other stuff that went on, such as, you know, how did they get the project? How did they get the funding? How did you get through all the regulatory things you had to get through to get your payload approved? It's basically looking at the whole early years of CubeSats, and it's specifically they're asking about like the OpalSat, which was Oscar 38, JawSat, which was WO39. This one I don't even remember at all. SSETI Express XO53. I don't remember that one at all. I remember the CuteSats. Do you guys remember those? The CuteSats, CuteSat 1, CuteSat 2, CO55, 56. And then some of the early CubeSats, the CO57, 58, which were your, what I think of as a CubeSat now. And then another one I don't remember at all, the DO64 satellite. So that might have been a digital one, only one that was not a mode I was into at the time. But the idea being is that they're trying to get these early CubeSat missions documented, because there's a lot of interesting stuff that occurred. And most of these satellites were put together by university students as a university project. And so there's a lot of other pieces there that you want to preserve, just so that in the future, when people are doing research on the beginnings of these tiny little satellites that were put up as basically an afterthought in a lot of cases, they snuck aboard another payload for something else, that this is be a really good book when it comes out. So very, very interesting. And like I said, there's a lot more detail on AMSAT's website, but you can get to through the ICQ podcast website.
Yes, certainly is, Bill, and it's interesting. Now, Leslie, I know you're an HF man and you don't do satellites, but you've got to be in awe. Satellites. No, I know, but you've got to be in awe of a 10-centimeter cube, you know, being put into space. I mean, 10 centimeters, it's hardly anything, isn't it?
It did make me chuckle when they were talking about using Learn the Metric System, and I did chuckle about that. Here we tend to teach kids metric, and then when they go into industry, they use imperial. So that did make me chuckle. What this story is also on LinkedIn and gives a bit more detail if people want to follow up on it. One of the things that will be very interesting is most people look at the technology and go, "Yeah, this is the end story." And actually, like people have been alluding to, it's that process of actually getting things and making things work and coming out with projects like this. And that process is absolutely fascinating. So I think this is going to be a really good book when it comes out.
Yeah, I hope so, because in fairness, a lot of these things are well worth a read, given half the chance. And sometimes we don't get to see a lot of these books. But another book for my bookshelf, I'm assuming.
Christmas list next year.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, sounds like it. Chris, what's your thoughts on this one?
Well, I think it's important that we do capture what's happened in the past. Technology moves on very quickly. You know, I kind of include radio technology in that. So, you know, IT, radio, electronics, there's a very quick pace of change. And if we're not careful, we forget what history is. And we learn from history. So I think it's important that we do go back and every aspect of technology, I think we need to be, you know, making notes and recognizing and understanding what's gone before so we can move forward. So yeah, I do think it's important that we I think CubeSats are amazing technology. You know, like you were saying, it's a kind of a 10 centimeter cube that's up in space that, you know, you can communicate through. That's you know, it boggles the mind really that these things are up there and we can actually, you know, like, for example, the Fun Cube, you know, we can pick up its telemetry and it's this little tiny device that's got solar panels and very clever technology. So no, I do think it's important that we capture that and we don't lose it forever, because, you know, think back history, you know, I think when they built the pyramids, you know, but when they built, you know, they had concrete in Roman times, but it's like, well, you know, have things been invented in the past that we've forgotten about? You know, how did they put those big building blocks there? So, you know, perhaps we do need to capture this stuff and make sure that the future generations can learn from it. So no, I do think it's an important and interesting story, and I think we should make sure we help these guys. If we do have information, please let the guys know, and they can make sure it's carefully recorded.
Yeah, well, these gentlemen look professional gentlemen that are going to write a very good book. I one of the things I quite often knock the internet for is bad advice, and there's a classic picture of a young lady soldering. Now, I say young lady, I feel sorry for her because she was set up on this. And she's supposedly soldering a printed circuit board, but she's actually holding the element. Now, seeing as that's going to be around about 300, 350 degrees C, you know, she ain't going to be holding it very long if it was actually working. And the smell's horrible when you burn yourself. But to get things documented correctly, I think it's a good thing. What do you think, mine?
Do you know what? She's soldering the wrong side of the board. And two, every single one of us on this conference now and every single person that's listening to this that has ever operated the soldering iron has all held the soldering iron wrong once. We've all done it. We've all... with the CubeSats, though, I mean, every time I read stories about satellites and things, I get the desire, I think, I must go and play with satellites and do more on this. I tried to open this. Unfortunately, it's a LinkedIn story, and I'm not comfortable with using LinkedIn, so I can't get into it, which is a bit of a shame because they've narrowed their audience. But that aside, I read this and thought they're looking to find history on this. You know, just no one record this anywhere. Surely you need permission to launch a satellite, because so there'll be central info somewhere. But of course, they're looking for the underreported human stories. The you know, and I can only put the context of that into like the stories that we had before we were able to build and put on air our repeater. There was a whole, you know, it's not just a case of you get the equipment, you go up the roof and you install it. You've got to go through all these hurdles and things of how are we going to do this? How are we going to build this? How are we going to get it into space and all that sort of stuff? And there will be a lot, you know, it's getting something into space. It's a lot easier than getting something on the roof of a commercial building. This sounds amazing. I will be honest, I have a very short attention span. I don't have the attention span to sit down and read a book. I might make an exception in this if it gets me in. Maybe there'll be an audio version of it. I don't know. I doubt it, but there might be. But I will certainly be more interested to hear more about this as it comes out.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the book time, if a book's on a subject you're really interested in, and if the author is flowing and fits your personality or your mode, you get much more from it.
Martin, let me interject one little thing here. Martin Rothwell was talking, it triggered this. And Ed, I hope I'm not stealing your thunder. The genesis of this idea was about power. How do we power a very small satellite? Because you remember at the time. Engine. Yeah, you know, at the time, you know, how do you get power for it? So they went, well, what if we put solar panels all around it on each side of a cube? And they went down to a local retail store and a little doll, and Bill will remember this. I don't know if you had them on your side of the pond, called a Beanie Baby. It was a craze.
That's what I was chuckling about, Frank, when I read it.
And they saw a display box. It was a little transparent box. We might call it a plexiglass box or something. And I said, can we buy the box? And so it was modeled after a Beanie Baby box. Sorry, Ed, I hope I didn't steal your...
No, not at all. That's part of what I was going to say, though, because the other advantage of putting the solar panels on each side, all six sides of the 4-inch cube or 10-centimeter cube, was if the satellite rolls, it's always going to be getting the sun anyway from one or the other of the panels. But I like Martin. Yeah, I had the same problem with the LinkedIn link, but the link underneath it on our website in the script from today's podcast goes to the Aviation Week article, and that one you can read, and that's really worth reading. I think it's written actually by the professor, Bob Twigg, and he describes in short form the absolute history. He was trying to teach about satellites to students that were doing a master's degree and wanted them to build a satellite. So he only had effectively 1 year to do it all in. And what was around at the time, at that time, it all took too long. They never got the projects finished. And then they came up with this beanie box idea, and hence it sped things up. What was interesting, though, as you read through it, you think of this as a US story. It's not. It's international, because the space industry run by NASA and by other large companies in the US basically laughed at them when they wanted to put these things into space. They're going, well, you know, if you pay us a few million dollars, we'll launch it for you. But otherwise, you're not getting space on our launch vehicle, because when we throw that out, it might hit one of our multi-million dollar satellites. So the end result was they found a commercial company in Russia, and Russia launched the first ever CubeSat. And then after that, apparently also a subdivision of NASA sort of got the idea, or was approached by the university, and they sort of officially, unofficially launched it. Following on from that, the standard got adopted by both commercial and universities. And then, of course, all the regulations came in. So one line that Bob makes in the article basically says, although it was all a bit sort of Heath Robinson-ish to start with, and you'd think it was difficult, it actually got a lot more difficult once they got recognised. They were better operating unknown, as the idiots over there, it'll never work, and to which he would respond, yeah, but it's education, so we learn through it, even if it doesn't work. At the end of the day, an international standard came in, first of all the CubeSat, and then the smaller versions, the NanoSat and so on, written by these two professors that are writing the book. And the industry now, the commercial industry, uses the standard. So what started out as a university project solution to get the job done in a shorter time ended up becoming a world standard. So this is actually a world story rather than just the US. And good luck to them. And yeah, let's hope they do get the book out, and we'll need to give it a plug if it does come out on the Ice Cube podcast whenever it's released. Back to you, Martin.
Just gone to that website that you mentioned in the show notes, the Aviation Week one, and there's a photo of the guy holding one of these CubeSats, and you realize how big they are. But the thing that's really made me laugh, looking at the picture that they've used, and it's clearly a photoshopped picture at the top of four CubeSats sort of floating above the Earth. It did look like there were four flight cases, like massive.
Yes, yes.
Around in space, and I can't help but think if this was taken from the International Space Station just after they swore a little bit having dropped their toolbox.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a great story. I'm a few of the presenters here, I'm hoping to read the book when it comes out, and add some more to my knowledge of our wonderful hobby.
I'm sure it's going to be a great read, Martin.
I hope so, Leslie. Yeah. Right, moving on to our next news story. Mobile base stations to expand frequency use worldwide. Now, Bill, do you want to go first on this one?
Yes. One of the things that came out of the World Radio Communications Conference in Dubai is that they're going to expand the spectrum internationally for mobile base stations in high altitude. This would be something like those tethered balloons at like 20 and 50 kilometers above the Earth. And the idea being is it would provide mobile broadband, specifically in an area that was doing disaster recovery. So, for instance, like a hurricane rolls through and knocks all the cell sites out, you know, somebody will roll in with one of these high altitude platforms on one of these designated frequencies and be able to roll it out for folks to be able to get communications going again, specifically data communications. And spectrum that they got is some spectrum in 700 to 900 megs, 1.7 gigs and 2.5 gigs. The main reason this was interesting was this was one of those proposals that could have very easily slid into one of the amateur radio bands, but everybody did a good job keeping it out of the amateur radio bands. We got very lucky there. Likewise, the other part, you know, I always want to mention is a lot of folks, you know, immediately say, you know, disaster recovery, oh, you know, roll out your local Aries, Races, React teams, and then you'll be back, you know, going with emergency communications in minutes. The world is moving on, and folks need to be aware of things like mobile broadband off of a weather balloon stuff and these portable FirstNet cell towers. They drive a tractor trailer truck out with a, you know, ready to go cell tower. They, you know, it's hydraulic mast, up it goes, and they...
Some of them are light trucks, Bill. AT&T's, they call Colts.
Yeah, the little ones. Yeah, I was getting to that.
Okay, sorry.
And so the delta between, you know, because yeah, like Frank just said, there's now one of these things that look like, you know, Humvees and Jeeps and, you know, these portable emergency cell sites and stuff that different companies are working on. And, you know, there's a couple ones that are built in the drone platforms now. They'll just fly a drone in a circle for, you know, weeks to give you service. The delta between disaster and recovery of at least cellular and mobile broadband is rapidly shrinking, and folks need to just be aware of that. So, you know, we have a lot of good things that we do in amateur radio. This podcast is a great example of international goodwill, which is one of the Part 97 requirements for amateur radio. You know, we're supposed to be doing this stuff to promote international goodwill. Well, also in there is emergency communications, and that is slowly decreasing over time, depending on where you're at in the world. There's still great disparity around the world. Even in Frank and our country, there's disparity between urban and rural situations when there's disasters. But technology keeps moving on, and there's companies coming out with new stuff, and they're going to keep asking for bandwidth at every one of these world radio conferences because they want to be able to roll in with a system and turn it on pre-configured, ready to go, and not have to go in and turn on and off frequencies that you're allowed because you happen to be in some imaginary line somewhere. So this is yet another tool in the toolbox that is folks should at least be aware of.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said, Bill, and I'm guessing, and Frank, maybe you can confirm this, but amateur radio, I'd suggest as we go forward in years now, is probably going to be useful for an initial quick and dirty get some data flying around between people early on, because we can put up simple communications units and get going. Yeah, the general masses are going to want cell phone and internet, blah, 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 which I think this will fulfill. Am I correct on that?
You are correct. And the second part of that is who can talk to whom. And by that, I mean, even with our first net contract, which AT&T won, a friend of mine on my portable ops team is a member of that as a wide area engineer. So I get bits and pieces that he can talk about. And so they still have glitches because not every rural fire department, as Bill alluded, is going to pay the freight to get on the statewide network because they all bill it back to the local unit, or at least many of them do. The second problem is even when they get first net on and you get cell service, not everybody has access to it because it's a scarce resource, and your cell number will have a priority code, and they'll open those priority codes as they go down the link. And so as Bill talked about the disparity, some people will still be without it. So that's always a market for amateur radio to get in quick and get some comms going and get A to talk to B. I was a hole marshal on a golf tournament, a professional golf association golf tournament here. And for whatever reason, maybe just because I look like the radio guy, I got a handset for one network and a handset for another network where the emergency medical was on. So the first handset was to talk about which players are teeing off and lost ball, backed up, whatever. Well, somebody got beamed with a tee shot off the tee. I happened to be the only person on the entire course that had a handset that could talk to both, and I was relaying stuff, and I was a half mile from the victim. Now, that's a small little story, but it illustrates this larger problem that even as we get more sophisticated, there are still pockets that can't talk to one another, Martin. So I think you hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, I thought I was getting an understanding of this. Hey, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the others have covered most of the points, but what I do notice is the frequencies chosen, you know, they're like 800, 900 megahertz range or 700 to 900, they're saying, actually coincides with what here in Europe we use for 4G and 5G in rural areas. They use the higher frequencies, the 1.7 gig in the cities, and since that goes up 2.5 gigs, I'm wondering what equipment on the ground is going to be needed. Presuming this HAB is the HAPS technology is in a HAB, a high altitude balloon, then is your normal cell phone going to talk directly to this equipment, or and your Wi-Fi equipment? And yeah, the thing would be a problem that the others mentioned. As soon as that goes online, it's going to be overloaded unless there's some way of deciding who gets priority. And I think you've also mentioned what does the amateur radio groups do in the interim? Where is their niche point, shall we say? It's probably fire station, ambulance, emergency, what I'd call 999 services or 911 in the US. Can't remember what the number is here, but anyway, you know what I mean? Supporting those groups from their different locations, interlinking, if you like, I think is probably where the amateur radio might be there until they get something like this in place to take over. Now, the question, of course, is how long does it take to get the amateur radio stuff in place, and how long, if this is in the back of a truck that just is driven to the top of the hillside and they launch the balloon and away you go, you know, they might be so quick that it's not worth setting up the amateur radio link. Once we see this kind of technology available and operating, we maybe see a bit more. But this, as far as I understand, was something that was proposed and effectively the frequency reserved on a shared basis, I believe. But it's still got to go for final approval to WRC 2019 in 6 years' time. And also, what comes out of WRC isn't the law in every country. It's a recommendation to the national regulators. So although the WRC says you should make these frequencies available, unless the FCC comes along and says, okay, we will make them available, then, you know, it has no value, so to speak. But generally, you'll find the larger nations will do that and the smaller ones may not. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, yeah, as I say, that's another problem we have. Wouldn't it be nice if we had a consistent ban plan worldwide? Hi. Martin, what's your thoughts?
Well, when I first read this, it says mobile base stations to expand frequency use worldwide. I read mobile base stations as cellular sites, cell sites that power our mobile phones. I'm like, well, initially I thought, well, that's unsurprising because everybody wants 4G, 5G and things like that. And then I read again and they're talking about this high altitude stuff. And they say any fixed point radio station situated 20 to 50 kilometers above the Earth. Well, a fixed point station, that would be a satellite because a balloon is not a fixed point. That would just go wherever the wind goes or whatever, wouldn't it? So it's not exactly fixed points. So I don't quite know how they would.
So I've done a little bit of Googling on this while we've been talking. So balloons or aircraft that, should we say, don't need to land very often. So solar power, it's up in the stratosphere. So apparently the winds are very low up there. So it's reasonably static location, I think, is the not the same.
Okay, there we go. That answers that question then. But I also look at things like, haven't we just cleared 700 megahertz for mobile telephones? We've moved television out of the way and things like that. Do we have to move things again? How long before, you know, we get moved again? But the other question, and I think this is possibly one that Bill or Frank might have more on. And America used different frequencies for a lot of things, for example, mobile telephones, decked cordless telephones, that sort of stuff. And I know that because obviously, you know, there used to be a time when to go to America, we had to hand out different phones that worked on the frequencies that were in use in America before the phones had, you know, wider radios in them. Does this affect people in America? Have you got more critical things running in those spaces, or is this going to be less of an issue?
That's a great question. And unless I pull out the magnifying glass and that big color chart with all the slices there, Martin, I would just merely be guessing. Bill, what are you got a thought there?
Yeah, LTE is very close to being, at least in the AR, in ITU regions, it is pretty much the bands are all overlapping. So the big thing is some of these are Japan only bands for LTE. 5G, I think, is even more closer in frequencies where they, you know, the bands overlap. Great example, the 700 meg band here in the States. I'm trying to think which one FirstNet has. Is it band 12 or band 17, Frank?
Yeah, I don't know, Bill.
FirstNet has the whole band nationwide, coast to coast, just for this. So when this gets implemented in the States, if FirstNet is one of the vendors that is going to use this technology, they'll just roll it out as a 700 meg band 17 thing, and it will just show up as an overlapping cell tower. Although it's not, it's, you know, it's on a balloon, it's on a drone or what have you. And like I said, from what I understand, a lot more of the worldwide bands for 5G are overlapping as well. I'm just not as familiar with them because I don't have as much 5G out here as we have LTE. LTE 700 meg LTE is a godsend, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle of nowhere. Everything is 700 meg. I go into town and I get like the 1.9 gig and the 2. Something IMT bands, but out here in the sticks, we get just the 700 bands. So I think that's part of this. And like the other part too is exactly what Ed said. This is a international agreement that still needs to be ratified at another meeting a bunch of years in the future. So this is really, in a lot of cases, very forward-looking kind of.
Can I jump in there and correct something I said because I misread what was in the document? This has been ratified at 2023. It was put up in 2019, so it's already gone through that stage. I'd read that as 2029. The next WRC, of course, is 4 years out, not six. But yeah, so this has been ratified at the ITU level. But of course, all the nations now have to think about whether they're going to adopt it in each country.
Correct. And like one of the articles specifically calls out a Japanese company that's looking at this technology. Well, you know, I'm assuming the Japanese regulators either already allow them to use these frequencies or will very shortly. So, and you know, like when we were talking about designated parts of the spectrum are 700 and 900, 1.7 gigs and 2.5 gigs. They're all LTE, PCS, and 5G possible frequency spectrums. So,
yep.
There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff here to unpack, and it's a very you know, I keep going back how interesting this technology could be. I mean, this might start out as just disaster recovery only, but what happens if we get to a situation in the 10, 15 years from now where you have a baseline high speed coverage with 5 and 6G in your local area, and when you're outside of the normal footprints, you get a basically like an emergency layer of LTE coverage with these mobile broadband high altitude platforms, where there's just drones or weather balloons or zeppelins just, you know, 20 kilometers in the air just constantly circling. And all of a sudden you have coverage, like my friend lives, you know, a little bit out further out of town, and there's no cell coverage there, and all of a sudden there's cell coverage everywhere.
I mean, I'm looking at a great diagram on the internet here which sort of shows the idea. I don't know if this is probably doesn't exist yet, but it sounds like the planning is going ahead. So, you know, your cell tower may go about 20 kilometers, I guess, depending on terrain. You got something about, you know, 20 or so kilometers up in the air. That's got 140 kilometer range, not 20. So it's got much, much wider range. The alternative, of course, satellites are much further up. They're in low Earth orbit. And with low Earth orbit, with physical distance means you've got more latency. So if you're doing data type communications, say phone calls, latency means lag, which makes it more difficult. So actually, because it's much closer than that, you know, low Earth orbit is, you know, 300 or so kilometers up in the air or more. This is only 20 kilometers. Actually, there's, you know, like a less than a millisecond or so of latency from what I'm reading here. So actually it's kind of fixing a number of issues here. You know, it's using, you don't have to go and buy a terminal to connect. You know, you haven't got a dish that's pointing to satellites going over. You haven't got specialist equipment. You've got your existing mobile handset. So it's using the same frequencies, the same technology. So actually this is quite an interesting thing. I don't know how it compares to, I don't know what the full pros and cons are to having, you know, like you say, maybe you've got reduced bandwidth, etc. I don't know how much bandwidth this can carry, but it looks very interesting. You know, the alternatives are things like Starlink, which we all know about, which is Elon Musk's project where he's got satellites up there, and that looks very interesting as well. But that does require, I believe, specialist hardware. That's not going to work straight with your mobile phone. This actually just means you know, you've got a contract now.
I actually got to get very familiar with Starlink, and my friend that lives, you know, 30 minutes away and no cell service, they now have Starlink, and I am shocked, I tell you, how well that works.
Yeah, my friend in 5DU who lives outside of Jackson in a metro area but in a very rural county, he's gone to Starlink, and he gets about 200 megs probably on the best day. And it's just changed from a 1.5 DSL line out in the country. Just a huge.
Yeah, we jokingly did a multi-person Zoom call because he has 100 meg down and he was getting like 35 meg up, and we did a Zoom call and it worked to each other sitting in different rooms across the Starlink connection.
So I guess this HAPS concept could be something that could be used, as well as Starlink. This could be another way of doing it to get better coverage over areas that perhaps you wouldn't traditionally get that on a cell service.
That image you sent is very fascinating because they actually show a three-layer situation where, you might have some low Earth orbiting satellites for some coverage, but you have a lot of these, you know, and this is, well, you know, the example you sent me, Chris, was you know, drones running the, you know, 20 kilometer in the air, you know, hooking your back, and they show a footprint of, you know, one drone in 20 kilometers up, you know, having a footprint of like 140 kilometers. That's phenomenal.
one issue, and Bill and Chris, you guys, and the others, Martin, you may know something about this. One issue I see potentially is, you know, we tend to think about voice communication. Well, you know, as Bill just said, a Zoom call. Well, that's a little different, but it's digital. All right, now think about this for a minute. Is this technology going to use commercial grade NAT, CG NAT, which is what Starlink uses? What was okay? So what? You have one IP address for 200, say, customers. If you have to have a unique IP for a particular data transmission or service you want to use, then one option is to go to a VPN, which typically slows some things. Now, do you guys happen to know, because you've read a little more on this than I have, what they're using on their IP technology? That's how ARDC got all their money, because Google bought a bunch of IP addresses, remember?
Yeah. I don't know. The devil's always in the details.
I think it was Amazon.
Another piece that Frank's not mentioning as well is the vast majority of mobile handsets are actually on IPv6. Under the hood, they're all IPv6, and they're tunneling or natting through to the regular internet.
Yeah, and carrier grade natting caught me, as you well got to know, guys, when we had the digital talk group, and I had to put in a VPN through to make it work, they're saying, because part of the thing operates from my house. Leslie, the guys have been talking without me inviting them in, which is great, because that's a discussion. But have they left you anything to say?
Not really, because I've been listening with interest, you know. It's not normally something I'm involved in. So, you know, and everyone's covered all the ins and outs of it. So it's been a good, very interesting discussion.
Yeah, I thought so, and lots of points come up on that one. Long, but well worth the discussion. Right, moving on to our next news story, and I thought quite like this one. Student project provides new satellite for India. There's a tremendous amount of stuff going on in India in amateur radio, but I thought this was a really good one. Now, I'm going to give it to you, Chris. What do you think first?
I mean, replacing it with students. If students are replaced with satellite, phenomenal. What's more to say? We've got a bunch of students that have created a microsatellite, and it is, sending out telemetry information and digipeating and all kinds of things. So it's a very useful, I imagine it's a very useful resource and a very great learning exercise, I'd imagine, to be able to do that. So, you know, hats off to these guys.
Yeah, agree with you totally. Ed, I kind of lifted this one from the AR Newsline team, but obviously they read it as a straight news announcement we're discussing. But what's your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, okay, so Maya is the new satellite. They did have a student satellite up some time ago called Hamsat. And I think, I'm trying to get the guy's name, but the guy behind Bitex, I seem to think he's actually associated, or he might even work for, the Indian Space Research Organization, ISRO. So the fact that we're getting another amateur satellite up there to replace the one that disappeared in 2016, came through the atmosphere, I guess, in 2016, is good news. And yeah, I mean, we see so much going on in India, and good luck to them. And yeah, I think it's always good for schools. In this case, it's the Institute of Technology in Samaya that's behind this satellite. And yeah, many more to them. I expect it's a CubeSat. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, no problem, Zed. A gentleman you're thinking of was Farhan, and in fairness, I couldn't tell you whether he was or wasn't part of this, but Farhan was the gentleman that produced the Bitex, of which I've owned a few in my time, made them, enjoyed them, and then other people wanted to play with them, and I moved them on. Let's have a look. So, Martin, what's your thoughts?
Well, I read this, and it provides new satellite for India. And I thought, India, for India, is this geostationary? Because if it's for India, then it's obviously sticking around the India area. But reading from the story we've got here, it does look like it's a CubeSat. I, you know, how many are up there now? And you know, then I think, oh, yeah, great, another satellite. Great. And then I read it again. Student. So it's a student's project. I don't know how old the students were that were developing this, but great. I would love to see their faces, though, if they did. They had to do projects on things like BBC Micros that we did when I was at school. So it's, you know, it's phenomenal that they get to do things like this, and, you know, good on them.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, I'm that much older than you. We're the only the only computer stuff I saw when I was at school was we got taken to Wimbledon College, where they had, well, they called it a mainframe. I would call it a mini computer now because I'm more aware of what the thing was. But they had a mini computer, and they were programming it with computer cards. So a long time ago, things have moved on phenomenally.
I have seen the programs on TV, the history of the secret life of the computer, and they showed a lot of machines like that. I thought you were going to come back with something like, when I was a boy, it was all abacus and chalk and slate or something like that.
Well, there used to be a phenomenal marketing tool. When you when the first IBM PC came out, if you couldn't get one, they shipped you an abacus, and it was pending your IBM PC or something, and they had this little abacus.
The IBM PC.
Yeah, but I used to have one. No, I'm talking about the 1982 when they first came out. You know, I mean, IBM didn't think they were going to sell that many, and you know, there were these abacuses floating around. And at one point in time, I had one, and I gave it away. And like everything, you think, oh, I wished I'd kept it, because it would be an interesting thing to show people. But hey, can't win them all. So, Leslie, and once again, a satellite story, but it's students, isn't it? It's good work from them.
Yes, Martin, I've just been looking, I've been Googling it while we've been speaking, and there's a thing called HamSat on Wikipedia, which gives some more information on this story. And also, I've been Googling on what the satellites are in India, how many they've been launching. And even if you go to the list of Indian satellites on Wikipedia, it goes from about 1970 to 2020. And there's listed about 150 satellites. Now, some of these are obviously not operable now, but certainly they are, how can I put this? They're reaching for the stars on this thing. And, well, you just think they are putting an awful lot of effort in. And this is, it's obviously a student project, but hey, this is going to be really useful knowledge to them. And I think India's coming really big on the satellite scene.
Yeah, certainly do. And they'll be coming very, very clever at technology, because their people just seem to be interested in it. Frank, what's your thoughts?
Well, I light up on the faculty member, faculty coordinators, Umesh Shinde, VU3CDI. Having been a professor, having had students, some listeners may remember me saying, they were undergraduates, you never, ever, ever tell them anything is hard, because they'll play way over their heads. You might tell a PhD student that project's going to be challenging or difficult. And I just know the pride that a faculty member feels when his or her students accomplish something significant. And I don't care who you're talking to in the world, you say, what do your students do? Oh, my students built a satellite last year. It's up in space now. That stands on its own. I mean, that stands on its own. So that's the thing I would add, Bart.
Yeah, let's say it's good news. It's good news from that one. And I think it was worth mentioning. Moving to our next news story. This one isn't an amateur radio story. I'm sorry, guys. There wasn't a lot of amateur radio stories we could discuss. But in parallel to us, the Society of Broadcast Engineers over there in the States are celebrating 60 years. Frank, I'm going to let you go first on this one, but it's 60 years is no easy achievement, is it?
No, it is not. And the SBE, at Society of Broadcast Engineers, is that sort of professional group that those engineers who've maintained broadcast stations over the years have looked to share knowledge, share certifications at times, and things like that. So 60 years is a very significant thing. We can link this back to amateur radio, and it goes back to Marconi. Marconi was a leader in amateur radio back when someone named Hiram Percy Maxim didn't know what it was and was being taught what it was by Clarence Tuska. Clarence Tuska bought parts from Hugo Gernsback. Electric Imports is where the infamous and famous, because of 9/11, World Trade Center is in New York City. So what's Marconi got to do with this? Marconi might have been the Hiram Percy Maxim of amateur radio, but he saw a commercial entity in broadcasting, and he left amateur radio, and the Marconi telegraphers became a worldwide phenomenon, and the Marconi company did as well. That gave rise to what then became Society of Broadcast Engineers, because it helped create an industry. And so, you know, that's just a very significant achievement. And there are fellow or sister, if you will, organizations, NAB and American Institute of Electrical Engineers and so on. So I'll leave it to the rest of the group. But I just think this is just a significant achievement for this.
Yeah, certainly do. I think it's a great achievement. Leslie, I mean, I know it's a state story and you're not a broadcast engineer, but some of the stuff that comes out from these guys, I've read the NAB, or I've seen the NAB handbook, retails at about $200 in the States. It's a well-written piece of documentation. So what's your thoughts?
I haven't got a copy, Martin.
No, unfortunately, neither have I, mate.
Now, I think Frank's covered everything. 60 years of continuous for an organization, that's a milestone, and long may it continue.
Yeah, as I say, good one. So, Martin, you've been more behind the microphone than the engineering on radio stations, but what's your thoughts on this one?
You know what, I have engineered a couple of radio stations as well as been behind the microphone on them, and it was before I got into amateur radio. So I was a lot of stuff that I didn't really know what I was doing, and it was a lot of trial and error. I sort of understood the basics of radio, having come from, you know, like CB days, and, you know, I understood the idea of SWR and things like that, but I didn't really know what I was doing. But I have built studios, and I have set up transmitters and studio transmitter links, and I've learned in often places the hard way how to do it. Now, I'll be honest with you, I've not really ever come across, I know who they are because I listened to the Twerp podcast this week in Radio Tech, and I've heard good things. I've only ever heard good things and very favorable things mentioned, typically by Kirk Harnack, about SBE. And I understand there's the engineers, you know, even though they might be from rival stations, you know, they can still sort of help each other out in the background. And so I believe it's a, you know, it's a really good organization. It's a good organization or body to be a member of, certainly if you're into that sort of thing. I would have loved to have had something like that in the UK. That would have really helped me out. You know, I learned the hard way. Now I could absolutely do that, no issue. But yeah, but I have, you know, other than all the best for the next 60 years, I don't think I have anything else to add on this.
Yeah. So like you said, engineers help engineers. Number of times I've been on site and an engineer from the competing company, sometimes it's that your competition is struggling or he needs a tool that you've got and he hasn't. We help each other out, engineers. It's not about stitching each other up.
You're all human beings, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
And it would work both ways.
Oh, of course it does. And yeah, it all works well. Ed, what's your thoughts?
I can't really add anything to anybody's what everybody said, apart from that it's obviously a highly respected organization, and as the others have said, for an organization to be to hold that respect for 60 years, good on them.
Yeah, I was going to say, good on them. Chris, have we left you anything to say on this one?
Not a massive amount, but I think broadcast engineers, amateur radio engineers, we're the same guys often. We've got a lot, you know, I know so many people in the amateur radio hobby that are also working in, or have, or are working in broadcast radio and broadcast TV. There's a, you know, there's a lot of overlap there. So, but yes, congratulations on their 60 years. Great achievement.
Yeah. Well, I've only touched broadcast for about a year, but yeah, there are a lot of similarities between what we do in amateur radio and what the commercial boys do. I know, and I'm not saying we would be able to just walk in and do their job, but we would understand what they were talking about, and we would understand a lot more. It wouldn't take long to make the transition, in my opinion. Probably I'll have about 50 broadcast engineers write to me now saying I'm wrong, but that's my opinion. Move to our last news story. Ed, you put this one in. Teenage amateur radio operators featured on NBC's Today Show. Well, any publicity like that on national TV has got to be good, isn't it? What do you think, Ed?
This was one that's been rolling around various media outlets on the internet. Yes, it's another contact with the ISS from a school. In this case, it's the Harbour Creek High School in Harbour Creek in Pennsylvania. The difference with this one is quite a lot of the school contacts are done by a telebridge. So effectively what turns up at the school is somebody with a computer, an internet link and a microphone and, you know, a bit of publicity material, etc. In this case, the actual students, was it 15 of them, are already licensed before all this happened. They put together all the gear, they ran the show. And we were talking about this before we started recording. We suspect that one of the parents of one of the children at the school who are doing this actually either works for or knows somebody at the local TV station, the local NBC regional outlet. And they picked up on the story straight away. And they got through that. They got good coverage. On actually the national TV program of NBC, the Today program, and good on them. And yes, the contact went well, all the usual ask 10 question kind of things. But at the end of the day, I think the news in this story, if you read the show notes, is the fact that they managed to get this national publicity for amateur radio in general, and obviously for the school in particular. And so maybe there's something to be learnt from this with some other of our projects, how we get publicity for projects that, like the ones that Frank and Martin are doing, and hopefully they'll mention those later on. Yeah, so good luck and well done for the children doing this and for the high school in allowing them and helping them to do it, and well done to NBC as well. And Harry Smith at NBC for providing the coverage. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah. Well, as I say, putting our hobby in good light is always good. Frank, it was your side of the pond. You would know more about NBC Today Show. So how important do you think it was getting on this one?
Well, the Today Show began years and years ago, and their first guest was a monkey. And so they've come a long way. Well, and that's a little bit of a joke for listeners over here on this side of the pond. There actually was a chimpanzee who was the first guest on the NBC Today Show. And it was really the first and premier for a long time morning news show. Now, Harry Smith, I believe he used to be at CBS and was the news anchor. He is very, very adept at doing human interest stories. And He doing work with the Today Show now, he did a superb job, in my opinion, of handling the story. And so it's just a PR that amateur radio rarely gets. And as Ed certainly as one sort of underscored, it's probably the biggest home run for amateur radio in many years.
Well, that's is good news, Frank. That is good news if it was that important. Leslie, got to be publicity. If we could get publicity like that over here, it'd be great, wouldn't it?
I tell you what, I looked at the video. I thought it was an absolutely cracking video. The students done it. The students put the station together. I don't know, let's say that's a year's work for a 10-minute slot, right? And not only that, the school hall was full of young people. This was the best advertisement for the hobby. Money can't buy this stuff. Enthusiasm, bit of get up and go, a bit of make things work. I think it was great. Thank you.
Yeah, I think if you were a child and you were the ones that were elected to pass your greeting or your message or speak to an astronaut in space, that's got to stay with you for the rest of your life. That's got to be a high point, I would suggest.
Absolutely.
What's your thoughts, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen these things before. I think the ISS is a great way to promote the hobby. I think it's, you know, fantastic that we've got ARIS, the organisation that puts amateur radio up there and gets the astronauts to get involved. But I think it's a great way to promote a hobby. I think it's a really good poster boy, if that's the right phrase, you know, a really good advert for our hobby. It shows that what you can do with some fairly simple equipment, you can do something quite spectacular. And like you say, we can give these kids, you know, I mean, we talked about smart radio before, Martin, and we talked about, and I know you can point about that a bit later on, talk about the different educational aspects that and STEM subjects and things that our hobby covers. This is a great example of that, where we've got, you know, science, we've got all kinds of communications and, you know, all kinds of benefits for education, amateur radio. And I think this is a great way of showing that. So, and it's also fantastic they got all, you know, on you know, national television in the US. Look how many people would have seen this and maybe thinking about, oh, actually, maybe that's something that they might want to get involved with. So, yeah, hats off all round.
Yeah. Well, it's a great news story, great publicity, and great to publicise our hobby and the good things that happen in it, which is, I think, where we're all going on that one. So absolutely brilliant. Okay, guys, let's find out what you've all been up to. Frank, what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Well, I've not been as busy as usual, perhaps. Took a little time off for the holidays and that kind of thing. But I have been busy with our Saturday morning amateur radio time, smart program. I know, Martin, you're taking the lead, you and Chris over there on that side of the pond, which I'm delighted at. Over here, we have our first smart activity with the Jackson Amateur Radio Club on March the 2nd. They'll be doing a program not for hams, for the public. What is amateur radio? Do they still do that? And we now have flyers that I prepared that's posted in all of the libraries in Madison County, Mississippi, which is just on the north side of the city of Jackson. And that will be the first one. Behind that library, there is a garden. They have a gazebo and some permanent picnic tables. And probably early May, when we can count on the weather being dry and nice temperature-wise, I'll lead an activation there so the public can come by and see amateur radio in practice. I hope to get Eddie Pettis over from the Vicksburg Club to come over. He's an expert in satellite comms, and he might come over and see if we can talk through a satellite or something like that. That, as we've covered today, that always gets gets the juices flowing for the rank and file public. Been acquiring equipment. As I mentioned earlier, I had a local ham who put himself in short shrift because he traded a Palstar kilowatt amp to me, only a couple of years old, for a new TS-590 from Kenwood. So I got the better end of that deal. So I bought the auto tuner, the HF Auto that Palstar sells, that covers the same frequency and power that amplifier has, and also bought their metered dummy load, 2-kilowatt dummy load, which came in actually today. So I've got that in, getting that installed, be working on my shack a bit more, finishing off some antenna design, the Delta Loop, the portable Delta Loop antenna. I've sort of finished two versions of that, one with a 4-to-1 Balun and another with a small AT100M ATU mounted directly at the feed point, and it tunes up marvelously. So I'm sort of finishing off that activity, Mark. But that's about it since our last episode.
Well, it does sound so you've been busy and enjoying yourself, which is the good thing. So once again, that's great. Ed, you were only with us a couple of weeks ago, and you've got through the Christmas period, but you have much in the new year?
Radio-wise, not really, because if you said I was only, it's only 2 weeks ago since I was last on ICQ. And since then, we've had a series of storms with winds up to peaking 140 kilometres an hour, but mainly around the 80 to 100. And then two times we've had major snowstorms, and I'm sat here now, and outside I can see it's minus 4 degrees. So it's got a bit warmer. It has been like -7 yesterday, so not really the weather for me to complete one of my New Year resolutions that I mentioned on the last show, which is to finish the 20-meter wire beam, trimming it, etc. But it's just not the weather to go out and do that kind of thing. He'll have to wait. Apart from that, I've been doing a few things on book editing and things, but nothing really amateur radio. Worked from the home station to one of my mates in Australia a couple of times. Band conditions at the moment are very good, and I want to get out onto a summit at some point and start taking part in the 10-meter SOTA challenge that runs the whole year. So I need to get my 10-meter aerial working as well. So lots of need to do's, but with the weather it's been, it'll have to wait. So that's life. We'll get to it. Back to you, Martin.
Yeah, it sounds as though things are moving anyway, Ed, and as I say, you haven't had as a bigger break as the others, so don't beat yourself up about it. Right, Leslie, what have you been up to?
Oh, what have I got away with, more like Martin?
Probably.
Don't tell everything, Leslie.
First of all, our radio club, there was a bit of a saga of the marquee, and we finally got our big 6x4 marquee. So job done on that one. Come the club camp, and that's going to be up and running. We had our Christmas functions, and I've got to put a shout out for Teresa, Colin, and especially Michelle, who was suffering with a cold. But they gave us some music, and they put a little band together, and it was really, really appreciated. I'm going to say one point on this. No matter what club, whether it's a radio club, whether it's a service club, or whatever local club you belong to, there's always people in the background that are making things happen. Yeah, please be kind to them. Please appreciate what they're doing. And I'd just like to mention Debbie and Mima of Chingford, because I think they did a great job at Christmas. Well done, ladies. One other thing, I had a bit of a radio rummage, as you do, and I found, believe it or not, a thing called a Grey Line kit. It was a thing called a DX Edge, and I thought, I've not seen one of those in ages, and it was just in the box, all the bits there. So that was my find. I was so pleased with finding it. So that's what I've been up to, Martin.
Well, sounds good to me. Sounds extremely good to me. You've been doing a fair bit. Martin, what have you been up to?
What have I been up to? It's been a bit quieter, of course, because Christmas and the New Year and things like that. I was back on D-Star again earlier on this week. I've been on, I want to say, 55D, which is a picture reflector. And I've been exchanging quite a few pictures on there. And it's quite nice because you can get on there and then after you've sent your picture, you can have a chat. And the thing I didn't realize that I had no idea, if you send a picture and you get missing blocks or anything as the picture's coming down, if someone retransmits the picture, because it's digital, it just like it it knows that it's the same picture, and it will fill in the blanks of what you didn't get. And it's just been really nice watching some of the pictures come down, you know, everything from people's shacks, very impressive, people, you know, pictures of the person you're talking to or their pets or whatever. It's just quite interesting stuff coming down. And then you can have a good little chat afterwards, just, you know, on that sort of subject and how things are working. So I had quite a lot of fun with that in the last couple of weeks. We've all mentioned the weather. The weather that has taken out four fence panels in my back garden, one in the front garden, and my HF antenna. My HF antenna goes between a fir tree that is halfway down my garden. One part goes up over the house, the other one goes down the garden and then round. And it's always been sufficiently loose that when the wind blows, it doesn't tug too tight. And obviously it got to that point that the wind was blowing too tight. The trees that they are mounted in were obviously blowing in opposite directions or whatever, and it snapped. The short leg is still attached. The long leg is broken halfway along, and I thought, oh, that's just a pain because I need to get up into the tree with a ladder, and it's a nightmare to try and get up there and find the insulator thing. So that's something that I've got to fix. I've been trying to come up with an idea. I've decided I want to try 160 meters again. I had it in my parents' house, and I had like an external, I want to say it was LG, but it was like an external tuner that would tune up. I think it would tune 160 meters, anything from about an 8 meter piece of wire. And I don't have that anymore because I have a proper tuned antenna and I don't need it for that anymore. But I wanted to get 160 meters, and my garden is, from the house to the far end of the garden, is about 20 meters. And I'm trying to work out how, or even if it's possible to build something that is small. And I see lots of design. I'm doing a lot of research on it. There's a lot of people saying, hell, there's a design for this. And all you need is 80 meters of wire. And, you know, oh my God, you know, it's, you know, I don't have that kind of space. Or you can put up a small vertical that's 40 meters long. And I think they've missed the point on compact. I have a mobile 160 meter antenna with a massive coil on it. But maybe I'll try and do something with that. But it was just something that I was interested in trying to have a listen and see what was going on there. And radio related, I've been taking care of our yearly radio mic license renewal at work, which costs an absolute fortune for private frequencies in London. We won't go into that, but I have been playing with some new digital broadcast microphones that basically get the same broadcast quality signal, encrypt it digitally and put it through, as you know, just as a microphone, as a radio microphone, in significantly less bandwidth, and it still sounds as good as it as the normal analog microphones do, but you can get more in the space. And I'm trying to work out how that works, and without loss of quality or without any significant latency. So I'm quite impressed with that sort of stuff. But been having quite a lot of play with that and quite a lot of fun with the Sennheiser kit. So, yeah, it's all good. But, yeah, that's about it.
If you need a design on a top-band antenna, I can help you out on that one.
Yes, please. There's a pork pie and a pint of beer in it for you, Leslie.
Done.
Separately or in the glass, I don't mind.
Yeah, I was thinking loop antenna, but Leslie's more of an HF man than me. Chris, what have you been up to?
Well, if I'm honest, not an awful lot. I think all I can report radio-wise is probably working on the talk, you know, just operating on the digital talk group that we've got. Other than that, and I think speaking to you, Martin, a couple of times, other than that, I've been away for Christmas, so that's a good excuse. So not a huge amount of operating, a little bit of radio club business. I can't remember if I've been on since we did the Christmas quiz towards the end of last year, so that was fun. And just been doing some kind of admin type things, I suppose, being one of the people that sort of do some of the backroom work, I suppose, for a radio club. So, and of course, I know, Martin, you've been looking at this smart radio thing, so what still your thunder? I know we've been talking about a little bit about that, but that's very much your baby, so I'll let you talk about that one. So that's about it for me, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, I know you've been busy, and we can't all be on it all the time, and so I know you went to visit your parents over Christmas, which is good. And you and I have spoken more than once over that period, and you certainly helped me with a couple of things I needed your advice on. So, yeah, don't beat yourself up, Chris. Right, what have I been up to? Well, I did operate a little bit more over the Christmas period. In fact, Mrs. B was actually quite tolerant over Christmas Day and Boxing Day with me having the radio connected to the talk group. And there were a few people that came up Christmas Day and Boxing Day, some of which I know were on their own for Christmas, and it was pleasurable to chat to them and have a quick chat. So that was fun. And I have done some operating from the car when I've been up and down to a few places I've been to recently. So yeah, it's mainly VHF and UHF and on the talk group. Right. Starting this Saturday in the UK, the day before this podcast goes out, Frank and I have been talking about smart radio, and smart radio in the UK takes its first outing this Saturday at a local library, where we're going to demonstrate to the public a number of amateur radio things and show them that they don't have to spend £3,000 or £4,000 and have a 60-foot tower to get into the hobby, bring youngsters into the hobby, and show people how it's a nice way to learn about things. You know, learn a little bit of electronics, learn a bit about geography, learn a bit about history, learn a bit about radio communications. And we've got a number of things we'll be showing on that at the library. It's only a 3-hour session, but if all goes well and we get and it takes off, we've booked it for 8 sessions, once a fortnight, for 8 sessions at the local library, and they seem to be very, very up for it. So I'll give you more of an update on this. And if it really does turn to be a success, then one of the things we're thinking of is, you know, showing other people how they can do it in other parts of the world and just giving them advice on how to do it. Because, you know, we can't do it worldwide, but we can aim to do it. And the fact that Frank's doing it in the States and I'm doing something in the UK means that we've already gone international on this, which quite impressed my local library, but I'll be honest, Steve. So there you go. Right. A couple of other little things. I bought some little PCBs off the internet, off my favourite, or not so favourite, auction site. These printed circuit boards are about 1.5 inches square, and they're Bluetooth receivers. And effectively, you can put a 5-volt battery onto them or put 5 volts power on them, and they've got a 3.5mm jack, stereo jack on them, and they're just Bluetooth. And the idea is I bought them so that I can put them into devices like computer speakers, so I don't have to have cables running here, there, and everywhere. And anything that would be nice to have something like that fitted. And they cost an absolute fortune. Not. The ones I bought were about £1.50 each, which is less than $2 for you guys in the States. So. Yeah, you have to be careful who you buy them from. I've seen them for £12 or about $15 each, which is stupid. But if you look at them, you can get them for about £1.50 or a couple of dollars. And for that sort of money, they're worth having a play with. They've got, if you haven't got a power supply, you can just plug a USB lead into them to get the power off a USB lead, to test them and make sure they work. And very, very impressed with the one I've actually had in operation. So, useful little device. You can think of lots of ways of using them. And last but not least, because I'm quite interested in the digital talk group, PiStar, Andy Taylor of PiStar, released a new version of PiStar, version 4.17. I urge you to update your PiStars to that, and you go into the dashboard, go up to config, and then expert, and it'll probably come up and say upgrade. But if it doesn't, there's a one there that says upgrade, not update, upgrade. you upgrade it and it'll go to 4.17. And this is not a tremendously big fix to PyStar itself. It's more to do with the underlying Raspbian operating system, but some of the keys won't work fairly soon if you don't do it. So some things will stop working because they won't update properly if you don't do it. So it's more a fix to the operating system than anything to do with PyStar. But once again, thank you, Andy, for all of us who use PyStar, because it is very, very useful to us. Right, that's what I've been up to. And I say, not tremendously busy, but all in all, I've been having fun as well. Right, all that's left for me to do is to thank the guys before we go. I'd like to thank Mr. Chris Howard, M0TCH.
Yeah, thanks, Martin. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming. I'd like to thank Mr. Martin Rockwell, M0SGL.
Been fun. See you next time.
Yeah, hopefully. And Mr. Frank Howe, K4FMH.
Thank you, Martin. I'll end with a shout-out to our good friend, Dr. Scott McIntosh. The daily sunspot number has ticked over to 183, and I think his team predicted 2.25. He's got to be smiling, my friend, Martin. He's got to be smiling.
Yeah, he certainly, when I chatted to him with you, he certainly did seem to know what he was talking about, and I'm pleased that it's all come right for him. I'd also like to thank Mr. Leslie Butterfield, G0CIB.
Thanks for having me on, Martin.
No problems, mate. And all in all, that was a good one. And Ed, you joined this one because you can't make the next one. But thanks for joining us, Mr. Ed Drent, DD5LP.
Well, thanks for the invite, Martin. And I'll now have a 6-week gap, and I'll hopefully get that antenna tuned in the meantime.
Right.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Cheers, well, all.
I hope you, the wife, and the dog enjoy your holiday. So there you go. And unfortunately, Mr. Bill Barnes got called away from work. He was with us, and then something happened at work, and he had to leave in the middle. So I'd like to thank Bill Barnes, WC3B, for joining us. And I'd like to wish you all a very happy new year, guys, and a happy new year to all our listeners. And we'll continue with the podcast. 73.
Keep your amateur ham radio podcast advert-free by donating less than a length of coax. Visit www.icqpodcast.com/donate now. For all the news, links and information, visit www.icqpodcast.com.
Now it's time to have a look at the news in brief with me, Colin, M6BOY. We start off with news of the HamSci 2024 workshop. They're holding their 6th annual workshop in the back end of March, the 22nd and 23rd of March, taking place at the Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. It's bringing together amateur radio community and professional scientists with the theme of alignments, especially those between the sun, moon, and the earth. So it's a great opportunity there. Registration is now open, and deadline to register is the 1st of March. They're also accepting presentations as well on amateur radio and science. So if you have a presentation that might be of interest to them, well worthwhile letting them know. So you can find out more at HamSci, that's HamSci, .org, and you can get involved there. Congratulations go to Paul Amersmith, Mike Zero, Papa Lima Alpha of Telford, Shropshire, UK, who's achieved the coveted Mountain Goat Award for gaining 1,000 activator points on the SOTA Summits on the Air scheme. Paul completed the mission on the summit of Polebank in Shropshire, as his feat took over 7 years, following from his first ever activation in December 2016. So congratulations, Paul, on your very fine achievement. Now we head over to our features episode, where we look at some of the hints and tricks in amateur radio to get you off to a fantastic start in 2024. As always, hope you enjoy.
And now, what you've all been waiting for, this episode's feature from the ICQ podcast. Hi guys, for this episode's feature, I wanted to talk about a few things that I've been up to in the workshop slash shack and some of the things I got caught out on that hopefully won't catch you out because you'll benefit from my mistakes. Number one, my mobile rig in the car stopped working and it caused me a little bit of problems coming up to Christmas. It's been bad weather and one thing or another. And just before Christmas, I managed to fix it. Now, why did it take me so long? Well, I went under the seat where the head, where the base unit is. It's under the driver's seat. And disconnected the lead going into the radio. And measured 12 volts quite happily. Definitely measured 12 volts. So I thought, well, that can't be a problem. So I have another identical radio. So I thought I must have damaged the head cable between the under the seat and up onto the dashboard. Now, maybe I damaged the head cable. Maybe it got chafed in the cable run. So I put another head unit on this radio with a short head cable. And still nothing. And I'm thinking, this is really strange. So I took the radio out of the car, brought it in, used my other radio's head unit, plugged it into a power supply, and it worked. And I thought, oh, it's an intermittent fault. I hate intermittent faults. Went back out, put it in the car, dead. And I started poking around, and in the end, I spotted what the problem was. Where I thought I had 12 volts, where my multimeter was telling me I had 12 volts, there was effectively 1.4 volts. No, I didn't get the decimal point in the wrong place when I was looking at it. What had happened is, and I've never had this happen to me before, the inline fuse had gone high resistance. It hadn't gone open circuit. It hadn't blown. But it had gone high resistance, and when I looked at the fuse, I could see that it changed colour. Now, to me, I think what it might have been is that it was metal imposed onto a plastic backing, and looked like some of this disappeared. And the minute I replaced the fuse, it all worked. Now, why did it catch me out? Well, for those of you who've been in the industry or electronics a long time, you're going to say, silly old fool, you used a digital voltmeter. Correct. I was working on the car and I wanted a quick and dirty check. No problems. I didn't want to be having to look terribly accurate. So I had the digital voltmeter out there. If I'd have used an analog voltmeter, because the analog voltmeter is a lower impedance, it would have drawn some current, and effectively, that would have got me to the fault a lot quicker. So, the thing being is, remember, digital voltmeters don't often draw much current, and that's what they're designed not to do. They're a high impedance, usually 10 to 11 megs of impedance, like putting a 10 meg resistor across a 12 volt line. You won't see much current flowing. So, just a thought. I was pleased to get that one done, and I'm sure some of you are going to go, silly old fool, you should have spotted that earlier. And you're dead right. I should have done. Now, another thing I was doing over the last few weeks was messing around with a device, and I'd put a little panel meter in, one of these little LED panel meters from one of the auction sites, to measure the output voltage, and I was trying to use a buck converter. Now, a buck converter steps up the voltage, and what I wanted to do was take a 9-volt battery and step it up to about 15, 16 volts. Not a problem normally. Stepped in, the display on this little panel meter wouldn't go above 9 volts. And I thought, the buck converter's dead. It's got to be. Scratching my head, one thing or another. Put another buck converter in exactly the same. And then I sussed what it was. This little panel meter has somewhere a 9-volt regulator or a 9-volt zener that hose clamps the little panel meter to 9 volts. So once I took the panel meter out, I put in, sure enough, I could wind it up to whatever I want. But that caught me not for very long, but for a few seconds, and thinking, well, what's gone wrong on here? So just a couple of interesting ones. You're probably laughing at me because I've had this problem, but hey, you never know. You might get it yourself soon. Now, moving on. This one is a tip, and I may be late to the table, but this one's a tip. I came across a video on YouTube talking about a product called DIY Layout Creator. Now, DIY Layout Creator is a great little program, and it's free, downloadable from the internet. And the idea is that if you're doing layouts, PCB layouts, and sometimes we use strip board or all those sorts of boards, you can actually lay your components out on a virtual board first and put all the interlink connections in and break the tracks and all those sort of things you have to do and check your layout works. Now, I'm sure many of you, because I can't be the only one, and I spoke to one of the other presenters and he's had the same problem. When you lay it out without doing a layout design, you start the left-hand side. By the time you get to the right-hand side of the PCB, everything's squashed up because you've run out of space. So this little package, DIY Layout Creator, I think is going to help some people. Watch the video. It's not only for strip board. You can do tag strip design on it. You can do the breadboard design. It allows you to breadboard design something on it if you want. And there's various components you can put down, which effectively, I think, is a very, very good little application. So I'm going to give that one 10 out of 10, because next time I have to do a layout for something, I'll be using it. And if any of you publish things in your club newsletters or in articles, then this is an absolute winner to do your layout so you can show other people how to do exactly what you've done. So just a little note there, and hopefully that was interesting. Another thing I came across over the Christmas period, and I have to be honest about this, I watched Mr. Carlson's lab and he started talking about these. There are little Bluetooth adapters. These things are about 1.5 inches square, and they effectively, you put power on it, it's a Bluetooth receiver, and it's got a 3.5mm stereo jack on it. Now, I looked at that and thought, yeah, I got some ideas to use those. I know Paul Carlson will tell us what he's going to use them for, and I'm sure they'd go through the roof the price-wise when people suss how good they are. I bought 6 of them for £9, which is probably about $11. You have to be very careful. There are people selling exactly the same thing on the same auction site at stupid money. So just buyer beware. But they are quite useful. Now, they do come with a USB socket on it as well, so you can test it. And the one I tested, I plugged a USB lead into the USB socket just to give it 5 volts. I plugged a set of headphones in the 3.5mm jack socket and said to, once it came up, my computer spotted it. I said, use this, and away it went. Worked perfectly okay. So use for this. You may be able to fit it into, say, computer speakers if you've got a set of computer speakers that are powered. If you can get 5 volts and you can feed the audio in, then it means you can turn those speakers into Bluetooth speakers and use them for lots of other things, not just your computer at the same time. Or if you need to send Bluetooth audio to something, this could be very, very useful for you. Now, last but not least, I'm working on a project called Smart Radio, which we're doing demonstrations in the library. And I was thinking about what I could actually show and demonstrate. Now, not at the very early part, but just a thought. There are these electronic kits around that you can buy for young adults. They can make umpteen circuits up. And the one I managed to get hold of has got 130 circuits you can make using these boards, and you do point-to-point wiring to components, and away you go. Great little device to learn. However, if you're doing this with the public and your children at home, I'm very concerned about them from a safety point of view. And you can say I'm maybe being a bit of an old fuddy-duddy here. But the one I've got is 9 volts. It runs off 3 AA batteries. Now, running off 3 AA batteries, I saw one of our students accidentally put 9 volts straight across an LED without a current limiter. Now, that LED, not only did it die, it blew the top off the LED. There was a piece of plastic shot up and hit the ceiling at the scout hall. Now, you have to be aware, if it's going to go like that, there was this bang and a lump went off the top of it. You know, it's a dangerous thing. The same as electrolytics. You know, if somebody puts voltage across an electrolytic the wrong way, you could have an electrolytic go bang. And there used to be a hole in my kitchen ceiling where I was fixing a radio for another amateur who had put a capacitor in the wrong way round. And I was very, very lucky that I hadn't got my head over the top of this radio when the capacitor went bang and flew out to the case, went up and hit the ceiling. So what I'm going to say is, when we do it, I'm going to suggest that everybody that's playing with these little circuit boards uses safety glasses. I think it's important. You might think I'm being a little bit overcautious and it's only 9 volts. But I've actually seen an LED blow up and pop the top right off it. I've also seen electrolytics go. So, in fairness, I think even if you have one or your children have one, or grandchildren, one of these things, go out and buy them a set of safety glasses. I think it would be well worth doing. And with that in mind, I hope that helped and was interesting. Thank you very much.
Well, everybody, as always, we really hope you enjoyed this episode's feature and the episode, News Roundtable, etc. And as always, we hope you pick up a little summit along the way that helps you enjoy the amateur radio hobby. Talking about enjoying the amateur radio hobby, we had feedback from Jeff Wilson, VK2 Juliet Echo Foxtrot, who was working Martin on the ICQ podcast digital talk group. And it was working away. Unfortunately, though, a storm came along and took out his internet, as say, on that QSO. But as I say, I'm sure, if you're on the digital talk groups or you have a digital radio, not quite sure how to get a contact, the ICQ podcast digital talk group is a great way of binding together not only people in our hobby, but people across the digital talk group protocols to talk away. So you can find out more information at, say, visit the ICQ podcast webpage, click on the digital talk group link, and you can find out more information from that section there. Well, as always, we'd like to thank our monthly and subscription donors for helping us out to produce this episode for you. And so if you've got value from today's show, please consider doing what they did and go to icqpodcast.com /donate, where you can, send your value that you got from the show to us. And so it helps us continue to produce your show for you every fortnight. So we really would appreciate you considering this and doing that for us from there. As always, we'd like to thank the guys that took part in the News Roundtable and generated thoughts about the news that's going on in the hobby at the moment. So we'd like to thank Chris, Mike Zero, Tango Charlie Hotel, Martin, Mike Zero, Sierra Golf Lima, Frank, K4, Foxtrot, Mike Hotel, Bill, Whiskey Charlie 3 Bravo, Leslie, Golf Zero, Charlie India Bravo, and Ed, DD5 Lima Papa. Thanks, guys, for taking part in the News Roundtable. Well, that just about sums up episode 421 for you for your ICQ podcast. We'll look forward to catching up with you again in a fortnight's time. 73's all.